In the first semester, we dealt with Rav Kook and Shimshon Raval Hirsch, the beginning of modern Orthodoxy. We were supposed to also deal with the Sri Deish, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. We never got to him, so the second section, we're calling it Movers and Shakers in Postwar Orthodoxy. And let me begin by saying whom I will not be discussing. Really, the three most important figures in post-war North American Orthodoxy, and let me explain why not. The first is Rabbi Soloveitchik, the Rav. There is so much being done about him, so many people discussing him, experts in his area, that I don't really think I would have much to add. In fact, the Rav has now entered the realm of hagiography, and it's becoming very difficult to even do real biography of Rabbi Soloveitchik because you risk running into some of the accepted truths and discussing things that, at least in certain circles, will be controversial. In any event, I'm more interested not so much in the Rav per se, but in the students. There's very varying schools of interpretation of him, and perhaps we can discuss a little of that sometime during this, what we call a semester. In any event, as I said, that's what's most important to me. The second of the most important figures in post-war American Orthodoxy, another one I won't discuss, is the Lubavitcher Rebbe. I really don't have time to go into his importance, except to say that the whole notion of Kiruv, which is so popular today, is without question something started by Chabad. Today, the yeshiva world dominates Kiruv, Eish HaTorah, Or Sameach, and the rest. But at first, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, the yeshiva world was against Kiruv. They didn't think it was valuable. They didn't want it. They didn't want these Balei Tshuva coming into their communities. And truth be told, they never really accepted it. If you know what it's like in the Haredi world, for Balei Tshuva getting shiduchim and things like that, but they did come to dominate it. Now, the problem, speaking about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, is that it really is a world to themselves. They have their own canon. It would take you 5 years just to get a handle on the Chabad canon, not to mention having a good background in Kabbalah and Hasidut. And I really don't feel that's an area for me to discuss. And I was even asked to write a book on the Lubavitcher Rebbe, but it's not for me. Finally, the third of the triumvirate of the most important figures in post-war American Canadian Orthodoxy is Rav Aaron Cutler. And let me explain also why, and why I'm not going to deal with him. I'm not going to say that Yeshiva University would have conquered all of North America, or Rabbi Soloveitchik's influence would have conquered all of North America, had it not been for Rav Aaron Cutler. But there's no question that without Rav Aaron Cutler, the influence of Rabbi Soloveitchik and Yeshiva University would have been much greater. There's no question that the Haredi growth would have happened even without Lakewood, just like it happened in Israel. But in Israel, there was a critical figure whom we'll discuss in this semester, the Chazon Ish. So too in America, there was Rav Aaron Cutler. And without Rav Aaron Cutler, Haredi Judaism, though, would have developed very differently. Just think for a minute about the differences between Chaim Berlin, Tervadas, the two old yeshivas in America. Think 1950 and think today, and you'll see how very different they are. And to a large extent, this is due to the Lakewood Yeshiva. The presence and the influence of Rav Aaron Cutler made sure that these institutions stayed to the right because of his towering influence. It was difficult because of this influence for any Rosh Yeshiva to stand up against him. One yeshiva stood up against him, Ner Yisrael, and they set up the Yeshiva College program. But that's it. The classic example is that in 1946, Rabbi Huttner of Chaim Berlin and Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz of the Tarvadas Yeshiva got together and organized what they called the American Hebrew Theological University. They submitted all the papers to the state of New York. It was supposed to be Yeshiva University. It was going to give credits in psychology, chemistry, math. No humanities, though. In other words, we're talking about a Lander college. It would have awarded a PhD in theology, an MA in communal service, and a master's of science in educational administration. And why did they want to do this? Well, simple. All the students at Tor Vadas and Chaim Berlin were going to Brooklyn College at night. Just think of the waste of time to have to travel and to be involved in an institution with non-Orthodox people. They figured they'll put it all under one roof. And they were granted the charter from the state of New York, but the next year it was withdrawn. Why? Because Rav Aaron Cutler prevailed upon them that there can be no yeshivas that have secular subjects. We must continue the tradition of brisk, of Volozhin. And this is all discussed in Helmreich's book, The World of the Yeshiva. So there's a good example of how Rav Aaron Cutler's influence was able to ensure that the Haredi yeshivas stayed to the right instead of moving more centrist. So, Sammy, you want to say something?
It seemed like there was any fallout from the Haredi world as opposed to why.
Kept out of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, of Agudas Yisrael, and there was a lot of tension. So they weren't happy at all. So when you say fallout, the fact that he was not given the kavod in the Agudas Yisrael that he should have been given, that other Rosh Yeshiva were given, is directly due to this. I don't know how much of this was in the news, in the Jewish Observer, but he was always looked down upon by the other Rosh Yeshiva for his compromises.
You can't compare it to the fallout of why you suffered. It was a much...
No, because the YU, don't forget, they had a whole humanities curriculum. There was nothing puzzle going to be taught at these institutions. Yeshiva University has always believed in freedom of thought. So you had philosophy. You had a famous philosophy professor. Some of you might have taken him while listening, Professor Littman. He used to begin courses at Yeshiva University, "With the help of God, I'm going to prove that God doesn't exist." I mean, you've always had courses of free... complete freedom of expression and freedom of thought. And that's what made Yeshiva University out of bounds. But this was just going to be like a Lander College type of institution, but that was not considered proper. Now, this influence of the Lakewood Yeshiva still continues. We all know that kolos have opened up all throughout America and Canada. These are Lakewood kolos, by which I mean that the leadership and the vision comes from people with a Lakewood background. There's people listening right now from Toronto. They can tell you how significant, either in a positive sense or a negative sense, depending on your outlook, the Lakewood Choral has been. I can tell you that in Canada, it has even overpowered alternative rabbinic voices. And I'm not speaking about Rabbi Kelman and the modern Orthodox, but I'm speaking about even in previous generations. You had great rabbis like Rabbi Felder and Rabbi Price, and their influence has been pushed aside. And I'm not just referring to the Erev and other things. In Scranton, where I am, there's a Lakewood-style yeshiva. The Kiruv movement, as I mentioned, has become a Lakewood-style movement, as have popular works of Jewish law. Popular works of halacha are almost exclusively written by the Haredi institutions. The very first, I believe, of the popular works on halacha was Shimon Eider's works on Pesach and Shabbos, and he's a Lakewood old-timer. When Rav Aaron Cutler died... in 1962, I believe, there were 200 students in Lakewood. Now there are over 4,000, and the place keeps growing. It's growing on its own. It's not that people are coming to Lakewood to hear the great Purim. Usually, if the Rosh Yeshiva of an institution are not outstanding, people don't come, and I've been told that the Tel Yeshiva is half empty because they don't have any great faculty members there. But no one is talking about Malkiel Cutler as being the greatest Rosh Yeshiva. There's plenty of people there who are just as great or greater than him. But people are coming because it is this institution in the world. It is the place of Torah. In fact, there are people in the Haredi world who look down on Malkiel Cutler. Some of you might know about his controversy. They regard him as a bigamist because his wife refused a divorce in Israel, and he left her there and came here and got a Heter Meir Rabbanim. So he's a bit of a controversial figure. But that doesn't stop the yeshiva from continuing to grow because there's a Makom Torah. The whole town is. The last mayor of Lakewood was a Haredi. And Lakewood has influenced us as well, the non-Haredim. The whole phenomenon of the religious Zionist kolos, Torah Mitzion, is a direct response to the Lakewood kolos. For one, the kolos created an environment of Talmud Torah in communities, and when the modern Orthodox became more serious about Torah study in the 70s and early 80s, they said that we have to have the same thing. Also, many people did not like the sectarian or anti-Zionist outlook, non-Zionist outlook, of the Lakewood kolos, so they created alternative kolos. So why not then have a class on Rav Aaron, if he's so important? I think because the classes we're going to be doing deal with thinkers, people who have put forth new ideas, paradigms, visions. And Rav Aaron was not a thinker. He was a builder. He didn't write. He wrote a little on Talmud and Halakha, but there's no philosophy, and that's why, despite his great social significance, we're not going to have a class on him. And instead, we're going to move on to the first figure, but if anyone has any questions or comments about the three figures whom I will not be discussing. How did Rav Aharon pull it off? Why was he so powerful? Money put... I believe he probably was regarded as the biggest scholar around in the 40s. Remember, he came in 41. He was coming from the Kretzky Yeshiva, the son-in-law of Rav Zalman Meltzer. At that time, Rabbi Soloveitchik was not Rabbi Soloveitchik. He was still, he had just come to Yeshiva University. Rav Aharon Cutler was the senior Rosh Yeshiva in America with a sterling reputation. And he was able to create a yeshiva pretty much from scratch. He had important backers. And it's not them or anything, but in the yeshiva world, you look up to people who are greater than you. And Rabbi Soloveitchik was really the only one who was able to part company with them. The other Gedolim, they listened to Rav Aharon Cutler. Not so in Europe. Rav Aharon Cutler in 1937 at the Aguda Convention at Marienbad appeared and spoke against a Jewish state, that we should oppose the creation of a Jewish state. The majority of the Gedolim disagreed, and they supported the notion of having a state, even though they opposed Zionism, but they knew what was coming. Rav Aharon was an extremist in Europe, but in Europe he was one of many Rosh Yeshiva, and he was not a senior Rosh Yeshiva in Europe. In America, he was the senior Rosh Yeshiva, and remember, most of the Rosh Yeshivas didn't get started until after the war. He came right during the war. He was involved in Vav Hatzorah. So he really was the most important figure. I'm asked, what are you by Lander College? There's a Toro set up a college a couple of years ago, which is almost a, in New York, a competition to Yeshiva University. They even took two of the leading Rosh Yeshiva, right, Parnas and Bronspiegel from YU. And it is a college. You can get a BA. But first of all, the Rosh Yeshiva run the show. They're very proud to say that nothing happens there without their approval. No one can teach there without their approval. And most importantly, it's not a real university. It's more of like a technical institute. You can study accounting there. You can take a course in administration. They might have some psychology courses. But you don't go there. You can't study the humanities. They don't have BAs in which you can have majors in the humanities. They want to keep away from those. So it's the slogan is Torah v'Parnasa. You go there to get a degree, just like in Ner Yisrael, so you can get a good job and live a nice Orthodox lifestyle without being a schnur and having all the problems that many of the Haredim do because they can't get decent jobs. But they don't have a vision of education for its own sake. And that was going to be what this American Hebrew Theological College was. It was the same vision of Ner Yisrael, to allow Yeshiva Bachrim the opportunity to, they can go to law school even with these degrees, but not to put forth a vision. You're not going to be studying Schopenhauer and reading Shakespeare and getting involved in Western culture. These are not really, in fact, Rabbi Soloveitchik, in the latest commentator of Yeshiva University, one of the deans of Torah College, has a nice article there, Memories of the Rav. They've been doing this for the last year. And he mentions that when he told the Rav about Torah College, this is before Lander, the Rav replied, and if they can study accounting and the rest, the Rav replied, this is not a university. A university is where you study the humanities. This is a trade school, the Rav thought. So that's what I mean by Lander College. Okay, so if there's nothing else, the first figure we're going to deal with, we'll go to 10 o'clock, is Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. Some of you have read my book on him or skimmed it, but take my word for it. I believe that there'll be a number of new material here, so you'll find interesting stuff as well. Now, I have to say that with this book, I was totally unaware of the great popularity. I had no reason to think that anyone outside of a few modern Orthodox intellectuals and rabbis would read it. The fact that it became so popular, make a decent parnassa speaking about it, shows me that not only is Rabbi Weinberg significant, but that in the wider modern Orthodox world, there's a great thirst for people like him, visions of his, and not only the modern Orthodox world. I get contacted still today by Dayanim, by people in the Haredi world, open-minded people who are fascinated by him. And together with Rav Kook and Rav Soloveitchik, he really has become identified as a modern Orthodox icon, although I don't know if he would accept the title, because like we spoke about last semester with Hirsch, in certain ways he is not what we today would regard as modern Orthodox, but to a large extent he is. Now let me begin, not at the beginning, but at the end. This is how I begin my book. Actually, I have to thank my father, who was the one who suggested I begin, and I think it really sets the stage. He was born in 1884, and he died in 1966. I'll tell a little bit about the biography in a few minutes, but let me explain that he was in Switzerland when he died. That's where he lived. The coffin was taken to Israel to be buried. They brought it to Shaare Tzedek Hospital, and the procession began to take him to the cemetery in Sanhedria. That's a cemetery where Chief Rabbi Herzog is buried. We're going to talk about him next class. You have a number of religious Zionist figures. The grave had been set up by his students, Yosef Borg, who was at the time Minister of Interior, I believe, or Minister of Religions. You have Chaim Moshe Shapiro, Zorach Varhaftig. The religious Zionist crowd, as they were going to the cemetery, a group of yeshiva students, a whole bunch of them, led by Rabbi Chesko Sarna from the Hebron Yeshiva, came down from the hill, as it's described in the newspapers, and stops the funeral procession. And a fight breaks out between, or an argument between Rabbi Chesko Sarna and the people carrying the coffin. And I describe this in the introduction to my book. After the book was published, I happened to be in a Sfarim store, and I met someone. Just happened to meet him. His name is Savitsky. Some of you might know him. He's from Boston. His father was a great Rav in Boston, Mordechai Savitsky. In fact, for many years, the adversary of Rabbi Soloveitchik. They didn't get along so well. But a great scholar. In fact, he's a perfect example of someone who proves the phrase that everything is Torah, everything depends on mazel. He was stuck in Boston and made a living from hashkachas and other things. Had he been in New York, he could have been a Gadol Hador. I mean, there's no question, objectively, he was as great as Rabbi Soloveitchik, as great as Rabbi Moshe Feinstein in terms of learning. There are figures like this. Rabbi Kreisworth was one of them, Rabbi Chaim Zimmerman. You have a number of figures who never quite make it, even though, objectively, they're as good as anyone else. So this Savitsky told me that he was a very interesting story. He was a student of the Hebron Yeshiva at that time. And the story I'm going to tell you after I've given this talk a few places, and people have known Savitsky, and they say that it makes sense, because he always was one listening into the conversation of Gedolim. He was in Tells before then. But Savitsky told me he is the only person alive who can tell me what was actually said in this argument between Rabbi Chesko Sarna and Chaim Moshe Shapiro, Zorach Varhaftig, who were having this argument about where to bury Rabbi Weinberg. And that's because he had stuck his head in and listened. I'll tell you also something interesting that he said to me. Before I tell you the story, I want you to know that at this time, Rabbi Chesko Sarna was not all there. I'm not going to say that he had dementia, but his mind was not completely there. In fact, in this last year or two, he died the year later, 2 years later, he was known to do strange things. One famous story is that he marched into the Bris Yeshiva in Jerusalem and started screaming at the Bachrim there to start studying Musar. Hebron's a Musar Yeshiva. There's only one yeshiva left in the world that's not a Musar Yeshiva, where they don't study Musar texts, and that's Bris. So he marches into the yeshiva and starts yelling at them that they have to study Musar or they're no good. So he gave me that as a preface. Now, what he said, what happened was they were arguing about where to bury them, and finally Varhaftig says to Rabbi Chesko Sarna, after Rabbi Chesko Sarna says that we must take him to Haram Anuchos, there's a whole area there for great rabbis, Varhaftig says, well, how can we take him there? We've already dug the grave. Everything's set. And Rabbi Chesko Sarna turns to Varhaftig and says, you dug the grave? Well, then put yourself in the grave. We're taking the coffin. And that's exactly what they did. The Bachrim physically took the coffin and marched off in a different direction and buried him. And the next day, all the newspapers, including, I found, even Davar, the Labor Party newspaper, they all had stories about this funeral. Because I don't think ever in Jewish history has there ever been a funeral like this, where actually at the funeral, there's a fight, or before the funeral, a fight breaks out over where the person's supposed to be buried. And everyone was wondering, all the newspapers wondering, what was it about this man that not only in his lifetime were people fighting over him, but even after his death, people, two circles, the modern religious Zionist types and the Haredi yeshiva types, were fighting over his legacy. What type of man was that? And truthfully, as you'll see at the end, I think maybe it's fitting that he was buried where he was. Rav Moshe Feinstein's buried right in there next to him. the other Gedolim, because although it appears that, as we'll see, he liked to live his life as a modern Orthodox Jew, perhaps in posterity he wanted to be remembered as a Rosh Yeshiva. It's debatable. Okay, let me give you the biography. As we do that, talk about a lot of interesting things, and then talk about why he's so significant halachically, theologically, religiously. He was born in Chechanovich, a small shtetl. I shouldn't say small. It's bigger than other shtetls in Poland. They even have a big Sefer Zikaron. He was educated at the Slobodka Yeshiva, the great Slobodka Yeshiva, and the Mir Yeshiva. He was very close to the altar of Slobodka. Nussan Svi Finkel, the elder of Slobodka. In fact, Rabbi Weinberg writes that the altar raised me like a son. We know that Weinberg actually lived in the altar of Slobodka's house. I heard from Rabbi Chaim Sarna, the son of Rabbi Yechezkel Sarna, the current Rosh Yeshiva of Chevron, that the altar of Slobodka predicted that Weinberg would be the Gadol Hadar, that is, the unquestioned sage of the generation. It never worked out exactly like that, as we'll see, perhaps for the personal reasons that we'll talk about. But he was regarded by many as the leading student of the altar of Slobodka. During his time in the yeshiva, he was attracted to the Haskalah, secular literature. The writers, Mapu and Smolenskin, Berdyshevsky, the rest. Now, this was not uncommon in those days. In those days, yeshivas were the place where Jews couldn't go to the university for the most part. So where did they go? All intellectuals went to the yeshiva. Some went because they wanted to learn Torah. Many others went because they wanted to escape from home, because they wanted to find a wife, for a variety of reasons, because they heard that the yeshivas were centers of Haskalah, centers of secular studies. Today, looking at yeshivas, it might strike you as shocking. To go to a yeshiva, it's just the opposite. But today, someone who doesn't want to learn Torah is not going to go to a yeshiva. They're going to go to a university. In those days, you had underground Zionist movements, you had underground Haskalah, and Weinberg was one of those people who got caught up in the Haskalah. We know that while he was there, that the altar even wanted to put a spy in his room. That was a common thing done to make sure he wouldn't read Haskalah literature. Seeing that Rabbi Weinberg was at a crossroads, that he could go either way, many of his greatest students went off, some of the greatest heretics came from the Vojin Yeshiva. I already mentioned Berdyshevsky and many, many others. Seeing that Weinberg stood at a crossroads, and in fact the altar knew this very well, because the altar himself was an adherent of the stories by contemporaries that one day he decided to devote himself to just the yeshiva world, and he burnt all of his Haskalah works, but he didn't want his great students to fall into that. So what did he do? He arranged a shidduch, a marriage, between Weinberg and the daughter of a recently deceased Rav. And the dowry, the nedunya, was that Weinberg would get the position. He'd marry the girl, and he'd become rabbi of the town. Weinberg actually wrote later on how the altar and his parents forced him into this marriage. Now, the city, another small town, although there are significant figures who came from it. Those who know Hebrew poetry might know the name Hillel Bavli. His family came from Pilvashuk. Shmuel Bialoblevsky, the first professor of Talmud at Bar Ilan University, and a great scholar, he came from Pilvashuk, and a number of other figures. So that was the city. This was in 1907 or 1908. He was given this position. But the marriage was doomed from the start. How do we know so much? Because Weinberg was so miserable that he brought along one of his friends from the city of Chechanovich, who had been with him in the yeshiva in Slobodka and Mir. And this person, who later became non-religious, a Hebrew writer, after Weinberg died in 1966, wrote a whole essay on Rabbi Weinberg and what his early life was like, how he discovered Haskalah, how, what happened. And he describes how Weinberg, this girl, was a simple Russian Jewish girl, 17 years old, could barely read. Well, she couldn't read. I mean, she could read some Yiddish, but Weinberg had known young women in Chechanovich, who read Hebrew, who read Russian, and here was a simple girl who maybe could read the Tsenevarena. He was with her, I guess, the first night or two, but after that, he slept in the shul. And he wanted to get divorced almost immediately. Problem was, the girl and her family refused to permit that. And I don't think you can blame them. I mean, after all, it's not their fault. He agreed to the marriage. But he was stuck. What could he do? He couldn't, she wouldn't accept the divorce. He obviously couldn't abandon her. So he was miserable. So from day one, he's stuck in a miserable marriage, which he's going to be in for many years. When I described your question?
Yeah, I was surprised also when I read your book that the altar didn't intervene and help his student, knowing that the marriage was doomed from the start.
Well, he did. The altar sent him a group of students, and Rabbi Weinberg set up a little yeshiva in Tovashuk. He's already married, what are you going to do? You divorce an 18-year-old girl? You raise a good question, Sammy, because Rabbi Alan Nadler, in his review of my book in the foreword, says that after reading this whole description, he doesn't understand what the big deal is. I describe how, you know, she was a simple girl, an ignorant, you know, typical Jewish woman. They weren't given any education. And Nadler wrote that something's missing here, because all the Gedolim were married to simple women who couldn't read. And the answer is clear, though. Rabbi Weinberg was a different type of person. He didn't want a wife just to clean his clothes and cook his food. He wanted a wife like people today want a partner. They want an intellectual partner. They want an emotional partner. They want someone they can relate to, like when we look for partners in marriage. He wanted someone who he could respect intellectually. Think of Rabbi Soloveitchik. He could not find a marriage partner in the East. He went to Germany. He found his wife. And those who know about this marriage, it was one, you know, it really is a model of what Rabbi Weinberg wanted. People would call up Rabbi Soloveitchik's house in Boston and ask to speak to Dr. Soloveitchik. And his wife would say, which Dr. Soloveitchik? So Rabbi Weinberg wanted an intellectual equal. And he knew women like this who were intellectually advanced. So that really explains why this is so miserable. While there, maybe to take his mind off his difficult circumstances, he begins his literary career. He begins to write. The author of Sobotka sent him some top bachrim. He had a little yeshiva, and he begins to write. Now, when I was writing my book, this dissertation actually, I knew that Rabbi Weinberg was a rabbi in this town of Tovashuk, and that's all I knew. And I wanted to get a sense of what it was like to be a rabbi in Russia, Lithuania. Lithuania was part of Russia, obviously, in the early part of the 20th century, 1910, 1911, 1912. And there are a number of Hebrew newspapers that were published. The most important was called Hamodia. It appeared from 1909 to 1912 in the Ukrainian city of Poltava, and it was the newspaper of the rabbinic elite. The Hamodia in Israel, which started, again, in Israel, was a recreation of this Hamodia, which is an anti-Zionist newspaper, the Haredi mentality, before they even had the term Haredi. So I went back to the archive, to the microfiche. It turns out that in the United States, there is only one place in America then, and I think today as well, that you could read copies of this, and that was at Harvard University. The seminary did not have, Yeshiva University didn't have. And the Hebrew University has a complete collection, and they make copies of the fish. Yivo has also some of them, but Harvard has the complete collection. So I began reading, and lo and behold, I come across articles signed by Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, rabbi of the city of Tovashuk. So I was immediately shocked and very excited, because no one had ever heard of these articles. No one knew of these articles. In all the literature about Rabbi Weinberg, these articles are never mentioned. So I felt a great, as I said, success. I discovered something that no one else. For people in the academic world, that's always a great thing, although if you're following what's going on with the blood libel now, you know that sometimes you think you discover something, it really backfires on you. But I was sure this wasn't going to backfire. But then I started reading the articles, and I was even more shocked, because everything in these articles stands in direct opposition to everything that Rabbi Weinberg would later come to believe. These are articles in total opposition to Torah Derech Eretz, to secular studies. In one article, he talks about how the day the ghetto walls fell were the worst days for the Jews. The only way Jews can reach their heights of creativity is in the ghetto. Those who are with me the first semester, think back to the Chasam Sofer, the very first class. That Rabbi Weinberg writes how a soul or a mind that has Schiller in it cannot at the same time have Talmud. That's a direct swipe at Hirsch, who gave the famous Schiller speech in which he spoke about how exposure to Schiller creates a greater form of Judaism for you. So this was incredible to me. Right before World War I begins, Weinberg goes to Germany. He had some medical problems. Now, mind you, he's been married since 1908. So this is 6 years. He hasn't been living with his... Well, in Germany, World War I breaks out, and he's stranded there. He's a Russian citizen. We know he was in jail for a while as an enemy alien, and he can't get back because of the war. He's not the only... A number of rabbis. The most famous is Rav Kook. Rav Kook had come to Germany in 1914, the end of August 1914, to attend the Agudas Yisrael Convention, the founding convention of Agudas Yisrael. There had been a meeting before that, but the founding convention was really going to be in Frankfurt. They had invited him, and he was going there to try to convince the Aguda not to be so anti-Zionist and to adopt a different approach. He gets stranded, like Rav Kook, like Weinberg. He ends up making it to Switzerland, where he stays for a couple of years. Then he makes it to London, where he becomes the rabbi of the Machzike Hadass Shul in London. And only in 1919 does Rav Kook come back to the land of Israel, where immediately he's made into the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, and then chief rabbi of the land of Israel. And if you look in the book, for example, Letters to Rav Kook, you see all the great rabbis. I mentioned this last semester, that with this new generation, the Art Scroll generation, others, they have this portrayal that the Gedolim of Israel, of the Yishuv HaYashon, the old Yishuv, were against Rav Kook and his opponents, and he came in, this outsider who was in Jaffa before and trying to take over. If you look at the letters to him, you see that, yes, there are members of the Yishuv HaYashon, mostly the Hungarians, Rav Zonnenfeld and others, but take a look at who signs these letters, who extends the invitation. The greatest Gedolim, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, who became a very close follower of Rav Kook. In fact, he knew him from before, from Jaffa. It's Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank that actually introduced Rav Harlap to Rav Kook, and Harlap became his greatest disciple. Rav Tukachinsky, Rav Chaim Leib Auerbach, the father of Shlomo Zalman, Rav Kook was his Messiah Kedushin. The Torahs, the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, Meir Sha'arim, most of the old Yishuv was in Rav Kook's side. And I mentioned, and I'll mention it again, that those who want to be enlightened on this, you have to look at Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank's letter, which is actually censored from in the Har Tzvi, but it appears in Rav Chaim Hirschenson's writing, in which he blasts Rav Zonnenfeld and the Eda Haredit as not... In really harsh terms, which is why they had to censor it. But that's Rav Kook. Now, Rabbi Weinberg was also stranded there. While in Germany, he begins to appreciate Torah and Derech Eretz. He begins to write in German for the German Orthodox Press. There was a big German Orthodox Press. And in fact, at this time, there was a lot of discussions about what's known as the Ostjuden, the East European Jews. Germany, by 1916, was occupying Poland and much of Lithuania, and you had a lot of Orthodox soldiers there and others, not just Orthodox, people writing back stories about what it's like. This is the first encounter these Jews of Germany had really had with the Jews of Eastern Europe. Until then, they had a very contemptuous attitude of these Hasidim, these superstitious people in the East. This is where Martin Buber, he starts writing, and others start writing. Now, Buber is the most famous. He starts writing about Hasidut. It's actually quite amazing. Buber, who has popularized Hasidut so much and who was attracted to it from this time, but it's really not Hasidut like we think of it. It's Hasidut without halacha. And that's what Weinberg, he starts writing also at this time. However, he's an East Europeaner. And he points out that all of these people writing about East European Jewry, these are Germans who don't really understand it from the inside. Weinberg begins to write the first articles about East European Jewry in Germany by an East Europeaner from the inside. During this time, a number of these German Jews wanted to, as they thought, raise the status, raise the level of East European Jews. They wanted to bring Torah and Derech Eretz to the East. They even opened up a Torah and Derech Eretz school in Warsaw. The idea was to bring secular education, to clean up the cheders. Weinberg writes about this as well, talking about how, yes, there need to be changes in the East, but it can't be along the lines of German Orthodoxy. Russian Jews, Weinberg writes, will never understand what it means to be a rabbi and not know Shas and Poskim backwards and forwards. It's as if you take a typical modern Orthodox rabbi from the 1950s and put him in Bnei Brak today and ask him to be the spiritual leader of these people. It's a completely different environment. Weinberg also wrote, during this period, the first articles about the Mussar movement in German. These were the first articles explaining to German Jewry what the Mussar movement's all about. He also wrote about the conflict over the Mussar movement, the first article about the conflict, in an objective fashion, even though he is an obvious believer in Mussar. These articles are still valuable, and he was able to include oral history. He is a student of the Alter Sabotka, who goes back to Rav Yisrael Salanter. So the first articles on the German in German to expose German Orthodoxy to East European Jewry were written by Rabbi Weinberg. And in these articles, you see that he appreciates term Derech Eretz. He's not criticizing it anymore, but only for German Jews. For the Russian Jews, he says, don't touch them. They'll find their own path. So he goes from before the war, before he knew German Orthodoxy, to opponent of it, now to recognizing its value, but only for those in Germany, and then we'll see where this leads him to. By the mid-1920s, well, first of all, he had, give a sense that the war ended in 1918. Weinberg could have returned to Pilbischok. He did not. He remained in Germany till 1921. He was still, and it was only in 1921 he went back to Pilbischok. His wife finally was able to give him a divorce. I don't blame her. Some 13 years, having been away from her husband now for 8 years, and it was never a marriage to begin with, but that's how long he waited. And immediately he returns to Germany. There was no longer any place for him. He had given his wife a divorce. And it wasn't just that he had given his wife a divorce. There were other rabbis in Eastern Europe who had divorced. The most famous was the Beis Halevi. So it wasn't such a taboo. I implied in my book that it was a real taboo. And Shaul Stampfer, probably the greatest authority on Lithuanian yeshivas, I would say he and Nussan Kamenetsky, although Nussan Kamenetsky is just a collection of facts. Shaul Stampfer is the greatest scholar of Lithuanian yeshivas, and he actually has a whole article coming out about the rabbis and divorce. And he's going to show that it wasn't such a taboo. There are plenty of rabbis who got divorced. But certainly Weinberg was not ready to remain. He had no job there. And even more importantly, by 1921, he had decided that German Orthodoxy was the thing for him. This complete change in 15 years from opponent of it to someone who recognizes its value for Germany, but not for him and not for the East, by 1921, he returns to Pilbischok, gives his wife a divorce, and comes back to Germany to make a new life as a German Orthodox rabbi. He never remarried, incidentally, and the fact that he never has children also allows many people to claim him as his own. You know, you usually get, which I described right at the beginning, for those who came on late, as I said, that it was my father who thought it was a great place to start, and it is, as you'll see in a minute when I compare it to Rabbi Soloveitchik, that they fought over him. Now, usually when you have a children, you educate them in a certain way, so people get a sense of what your hashkafa, what your outlook is. Although, not always, though, because just look at Rabbi Soloveitchik, there's a big fight right now about his legacy, and if you look at his children, he sent all his children to Harvard. All of his children are big, strong backers of secular education for their own sake. Two of his children have doctorates, one in American history, another in Jewish history. One from Harvard, that's his daughter Atara, a doctor from Harvard in American history. And despite the fact that his whole life, and he educated his children this way, there still is disputes about, in fact, Rabbi Shurkin, some of you might know him, one of my Soloveitchik students from the 70s, from that era where they became much more right-wing. In fact, the Rav spoke about this, the students becoming more right-wing. He actually told Rabbi Lichtenstein's wife, that you don't know your father. You only know him from the 50s. We know him from the 70s when he rejected all this stuff. In any event, Rabbi Weinberg didn't have children, and therefore it made it easier then to argue about him. Did he want to remarry? Did he want to try? It's hard to say. He was already, when he came to Germany, he was almost 40 years old. It's not so easy to marry a 40-year-old. I know a rabbi who's now passed away who was in Germany would mention to me that sometimes Rabbi Weinberg would point out a woman who was married and said, if she wasn't married, I would marry her. And after the war, the Mrs. Weingord, who was almost 30 years younger than him, she was in love with him. I'll describe the story in a minute. And in a sense, Weinberg was in love with her, but it was a more of like a fatherly love. He never remarried, and I will say that a lot of the issues I'll speak about in a few minutes probably could have been solved had he been married. Had he had a wife in which to discuss all these issues with, he's always his negative feelings about so many people. You know, if you have a wife, you can discuss it with her. He didn't have a wife, so all of his letters are full of his anger and his lashon hara and his knocking these people. He would have been able to tell this to his wife or his therapist, and he wouldn't. It's possible the reason he couldn't get married is, if you read these letters, something you see about him is that he is a perfectionist. To be married obviously requires compromise, to recognize people's faults. He doesn't seem to have the ability to recognize faults. He has such a high standard. Anytime he sees someone who appears to be interested in his kavod, or in which is a natural thing, or he's criticizing everyone. It's almost as if his standards were so high that he wouldn't have been able to live with someone, to be able to compromise, to be able to accept someone else's faults. And I think as he got older, this becomes more and more apparent that, and as we know, when people who are not married get older, it becomes harder and harder for them to get out of their ways. So I would assume he wanted to remarry. All Jews should want to fulfill the mitzvah of having children. He even writes in one of his drashot, he gave a drashot for a marriage, that someone who's not married is not complete. You know, it comes from the Gemara, and he develops this idea. It's ironic, because here is a man who's not married talking about how without having a wife as your partner, you're not complete. But he never remarried. Leave it at that. And I remember after I wrote my book, some guy from Chaim Berlin Yeshiva calls me up and says, I know the real reason why Rabbi Weinberg didn't remarry. He had a medical problem. He couldn't have children, therefore he couldn't marry. I mean, these people just make these things up. There's all sorts of stories that float around the yeshiva world about various gedolim, including about Rabbi Weinberg, and there's no truth to that whatsoever. He returns to Germany, and he goes to a place called Gießen. Small town. You'd say, why go to Gießen? Berlin, it's where it was where it was at. That's where Soloveitchik went. That's where the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Huttner, Chernikovsky, all the great people. Rabbi Weinberg goes to Gießen. Why does he go to Gießen? No. He goes to Gießen to study at the university there. There was a man in Gießen named Paul Kala. He was the leading scholar in the world of Masoretic studies and of the Targum. He happened to be also a great lover of Jews. When the Nazis came to power, he had to flee Germany, because the Nazis were after him, and he was a great lover of the Jewish people. He was a great friend to Rabbi Weinberg. If you read Rabbi Weinberg's letters to him, you see it. Rabbi Weinberg had a love for him, and this is very important, because in a few minutes, or maybe next class, we'll talk about Rabbi Weinberg's views of Jewish law and how it relates to non-Jews and how he was very unhappy, and a lot of this is motivated by the fact that his friendship with Kala. Rabbi Weinberg, I believe, is the only posek in history who had a deep, indeed intimate friendship with a non-Jew. Just think of other gedolim. You have people. You have, let's say, Rabbi Avadia Sfarno. He taught non-Jews. You know, he taught non-Jews, Hebrew and things. But I'm not talking about teacher or professional relationship. I'm talking about a deep and intimate friendship. What other gedolim in history has ever had a real relationship with non-Jews? And that has to affect you. When I was living in Boston, I was collecting, writing my dissertation, I would often go down to the Boston University area, Commonwealth Avenue, and I'd walk on the streets, and there'd be a sign in front of one of the buildings, Albert Einstein Archives. So usually it would be on Sundays, I wouldn't pay it any mind. Once I happened to be walking by there during the daytime and during the week. So I decided, I'd go in there, I said, the Einstein Archive, I had collected many letters from Rabbi Weinberg, and I said, it just makes sense that Weinberg, knowing who he was, what he became, he would have to go in to see Einstein. Maybe there are letters to him. They went to the computer, and within 5 minutes, they had a copy of a letter. They had there in Boston University a complete copy of all the letters of Einstein. The originals are in Hebrew University. And within 5 minutes, they had a letter, a German letter, from Rabbi Weinberg, still on his stationery, Rabbi of Tilvashuk, signed in 1920, I believe the date is. thanking Einstein, he calls him the great son of our people, for his recommendation. This would have been a recommendation, I believe, for the University of Giessen, and asking when he can come visit him again. So it made sense. He goes to Giessen, he studies Targum and Greek and all sorts of academic pursuits, because to be a rabbi in Germany, you have to be a rabbiner doctor, you have to have a secular education. He comes from Giessen to Berlin, where he's appointed professor, they called it lecturer, in Talmud and Codes at the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. And by that time, by 1924, 1925, he is a complete advocate of the German Orthodox system of Torah and civilization, of joining the two, of being involved in the world. It was interesting because at that very period, a different phenomenon was taking place. We all know today that you have students who go off to Israel, and then they come back much more religious than their parents. It's a big issue. Many parents know about this. Other parents really don't have any clue, and it's quite a shock when they come back. And all of a sudden now, maybe they're wearing a jacket or a hat, or they want a little higher level hashkacha, all sorts of things. They're shuckling a little more. The same thing was going on in the 1920s. In the 1920s, a whole group, hundreds, we think even in the 1920s it got up to 1,000 students in total, left Germany and went to study at the great yeshivas of Eastern Europe. Ponevezh, which was just starting out, but it became a big yeshiva. Tells, Slobodka, Mir, and a number of other yeshivas. And they came back to Germany. And when they came back to Germany, they were rejecting their parents. To be a German Jew, an Orthodox German Jew, meant, like I said, you read Schiller, you went to the opera, you were involved in culture. They didn't want this. They wanted something more authentic in their mind. In fact, they opened up an organization, a group called Torah U'Musar. That is, they were not interested in Derech Eretz and knowing what it meant to be a good German citizen. They wanted to study Torah and also Musar. So there was a whole movement away from the Hirschian philosophy in the 20s. It's a good question. How did the German rabbinate respond to this trend? There were some rabbis also, young rabbis, who were moving away as well, believing that German Orthodoxy had failed. This was the years after the war. There was rise of anti-Semitism in the 20s. What it meant to be a German citizen had suffered a lot in the years after the World War I, with the total collapse, the economic collapse. There didn't seem to be much pride left in Germany. Zionism had come on the scene. You know, if you're interested in Zionism, what interest do you have in being a German citizen? So term Derech Eretz was suffering. But who could respond? You ask, what did the German rabbinate respond to this trend? Who was able to respond? That's where Weinberg enters the picture. Because Weinberg, it's so ironic. The man coming from Eastern Europe comes to Germany. He becomes the leading and most important advocate of Torah and Derech Eretz to these people at the very time that the native Germans are rejecting Torah and Derech Eretz. So it's a great irony there. The classic example of rejection of Torah and Derech Eretz was Rabbi Schwab, later the rabbi in Washington Heights. He left. He went to study for many years in Eastern Europe. He comes back to Germany and writes a book, How Torah and Derech Eretz Has Failed. And he was the rabbi in Ichenhausen, I believe it was, right outside Frankfurt, and he writes a book saying the term Derech Eretz has failed, it doesn't apply anymore, it maybe was good in Hirsch's generation. 30 years after that, he writes another little book called These and Those, and he changed his tune. I interviewed him for my book before he passed away. He did a complete reversal, and it was only later on, when he was in his 20s and 30s, he was a hothead, I guess you could say, and he rejected the term Derech Eretz. Later on, when he was in his 50s and 60s, he came again to the conclusion, came back to his parents' ideas and German Orthodox ideas, that really it is a wonderful ideology, not for everyone, but it was able to accomplish things that other ideologies couldn't. And remember I spoke about the first semester, Rabbi Dessler's letter attacking Torah and Derech Eretz? Schwab published an anonymous, which later came out that it was him, an anonymous article in opposition to Dessler, explaining why Rabbi Dessler has distorted the history of German Orthodoxy and how German Orthodoxy, the fact that he didn't produce Gedolim, fine, but they produced religious communities. And it's a wonderful letter, and he published a little English pamphlet to those who are interested called These and Those, in which he describes the both approaches, the both ideologies. Yeah.
it was just in the world of thought that he advocated.
Okay, well, let's talk about him. When I say that he advocated, to be a German Orthodox Jew meant that this is the sort of thing that you involve yourself in. It doesn't mean that for everyone. For example, Hildesheimer didn't have the same view of Hirsch. We spoke about this last semester, that you're going to discover God, you're going to discover Torah by listening to music and Schiller and all that sort of stuff. But this is what it meant to be part of the Western world. This is part of culture. It makes you a complete person. There's no question that Weinberg thought these things were valuable. He writes at the beginning of the Shrita Yesh what it meant to be part of the world. I asked Rabbi Rakov, one of his students, did he have an appreciation for music? And he said he didn't know. But he certainly had an appreciation for literature. He was more of an intellectual. He wasn't an emotional type of person. He wasn't an artistic type. But this was part of what it meant to be in German culture. If you told someone, the same...
Weinberg be the kind to go to the opera or go to music.
I don't know if he was an opera lover. I mean, German Orthodox all went to the opera. In fact, in the next Torah Mata journal, I publish stuff from this letter of Schwab that has never before appeared in print, in which he's writing to the East European Gedolim. One of the things he did is he wrote to the East European Gedolim telling them they have to condemn Dorian Derech Eretz, and he mentions this going to the opera. In fact, there was a... the dean of Yeshiva College, his name escapes me now. He's the grandfather of Ephraim Zuroff. He died at one of the graduations. He dropped dead right at the graduation. His name is D. Zar, yes. He told a famous story that he went to Berlin. He used to go to visit his mother lived. He came, by the way. Dean Zar was a student at the Tel's Yeshiva. Some of you, I'm sure, are Yeshiva graduates. You remember him. He would go back to South Africa from America via Berlin. He'd go to Hamburg because Ramosha Soloveitchik would send him there, pay his way to visit his son. Ramosha Soloveitchik was in Berlin from 1926 to 31. And Dean Zar once told the story that Ramosha Soloveitchik still owed him a trip to the opera because one of the times that they went there, they were supposed to go to the opera and they couldn't make it there. So, I mean, going to the opera was, everyone went to the opera. Did Rabbi Weinberg go? I'm assuming he went, but I don't have any... he never discussed it. I don't know if he had an appreciation for music, but it's funny. I have a letter from Rabbi Weinberg that's never appeared in print. He's discussing Rav Nachum Ziv, who's Rav Simcha Zissel, of Kelm's son, who went off to Germany and became like a Musar personality in Germany. He dressed like Rabbi Saul Salanter when he was in Germany. He dressed in German clothes, the whole bit. And he's describing how he was a German gentleman, and he says, and of course he shook women's hands. I mean, that's the sort of thing you did in Germany. So I don't know if Rabbi Weinberg was a music lover himself, but he was a believer in culture, certainly. And I'll talk a little bit more about what he told his students. The question was he interested in music and art? He was interested in art, but not in... I don't know about music. I don't know. You know, music is hard if you're not brought up on it. To try to pick up music and gain an appreciation for music in your 40s, you know, it's one thing when you grow up with it, when you're brought up with it, but to start gaining in your 40s, I don't know if he was ever able to gain an appreciation for opera. And much like any of us, would be hard if we never had it. He told the students, and he published this, he told his students at the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary not to feel second rate comparing their lifestyle to the Torah-only lifestyle of Eastern Europe. Think of the picture here. You have these students at the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary training to be rabbis, and they're feeling second class. They're looking over their shoulders because you have their friends coming back from Eastern Europe telling them, why are you wasting your time at the Rabbinical Seminary where you also study history and philosophy, and at the same time you go to the University of Berlin? Everyone did. If you go to Germany today, you can go to it. It's on Artilleriestrasse, which today is called Tucholskystrasse. It's been revived, not the seminary, but the Agas Yisrael Orthodox community has the building. There's a kosher restaurant there and a place you can sleep. Right down the street is the University of Berlin, not too far, and also on that street was the Reform Seminary. So they were feeling second rate. They were feeling like, I guess, a lot of modern Orthodox Jews maybe feel sometimes, like, is this really the right way? Weinberg told them, don't feel second rate. He told them, remember, you are following in the path of Hirsch, of Hildesheimer, of David Zvi Hoffman. The Berlin Rabbinical Seminary was founded by Hildesheimer. Rav David Zvi Hoffman, the greatest posek of 20th century Germany, One of the greatest postkin of the 20th century was the head of it. And they should feel, he died in 22, they should feel proud and honored to have such honored forebears. Weinberg was the replacement of Hoffman to teach Talmud and codes. There was a Avram Kaplan who was there for 2 years, but he passed away, and then Weinberg took over. At this time, by 1924, he was teaching, as I said, Talmud and codes, which made him the leading halachist, the leading posek in Germany, since most, almost all German rabbis, young German rabbis, were graduates of the rabbinical seminary. So therefore, whenever they had questions, he decided it. He then becomes, by taking this position, the posek of, it's as if Yeshiva University had, instead of having a group of Rosh Yeshiva, had one person, really, who taught poskim and was recognized, and there was an official position as posek of the yeshiva, something of that nature. That's the one Weinberg came into. Now, what was the purpose of this rabbinical seminary? Well, it wasn't like Yeshiva University. Yeshiva University, and this is how they have always wanted it, is a yeshiva in the morning, and then there's a university. In fact, Rabbi Soloveitchik, you can see excerpts of this in Rakevitz's book, he was very proud of this, that he was opposed to synthesis, although that's the big word of Norman Lamb and Torah Mata. Rabbi Soloveitchik was opposed to synthesis. He believed that this is a yeshiva. Oh, was there any attraction to the realm of Putin, Lubavitcher Rebbe, or Weinberg? Very interesting you ask. Let me start with Lubavitcher Rebbe. Lubavitcher Rebbe was there. He knew Weinberg. I don't think he knew him very well, because Weinberg doesn't mention him that much. But something very interesting happened after the Rebbe passed away. Everyone started then doing histories of the Rebbe and everything, and then people started wondering, well, where did the Rebbe get smicha? He clearly was a great Talmud Chacham. No question about it. And the biography of him still hasn't been written. His years in Berlin, his years in Paris. So there's a lot to be said. And they were into Rav Huttner and Lubavitcher Rebbe, of course, and the Rav were in school together. In fact, I mentioned last semester about the yarmulke. There's a famous story where some of the students asked Rav Huttner, is it true that in the University of Berlin, when the Lubavitcher Rebbe was in class, he would have his books, but on top of his books, he'd have a sefer, and he'd be learning all the time, Yomim V'Layla, and Rav Huttner replied that he finds it hard to believe that the Lubavitcher Rebbe would learn Talmud without a yarmulke. You know, because, of course, no one wore yarmulkes there. But, so how did the Rebbe get smicha? And did he have smicha? Well, of course, the Lubavitcher is, obviously, he must have had smicha, he's a gadol, whatever. Beginning in the 1990s, shortly after the Rebbe passed away, an article started appearing, and I was able, with the help of the Lyozhna Rebbe, Deutsch, to trace this to this Garelic in Italy, who puts hefshers on some wine in Milan. He's a real messianist. He apparently is the first one. They started coming up with this idea that, you know where the Rebbe got smicha? Weinberg gave him smicha. And they have whole stories. Look in Deutsch's book on this, how he came to the Weinberg, and Weinberg tested him, the whole thing, and was so impressed, he gave him smicha. It's nothing there. No one ever mentioned this. No one ever heard of this, that the Rebbe got smicha from Weinberg, or anyone else for that matter. As far as I know, the Rebbe never had smicha. Not to take away from his learning, he's a great Torah scholar. But after the Rebbe died, they came up with this legend, because what else could they do? The Rebbe was in Berlin. They certainly didn't get smicha in Paris. He didn't have smicha before. He's in Berlin. Who's the gadol in Berlin? So it must be the Rebbe. And we know the Rebbe went to the seminary a few times. We have eyewitnesses that saw him there. But this idea that Weinberg gave him smicha is a complete baba maisa invented by Lubavitchers. We'll go 2 more minutes. Let me just say, with the Rav and Rav Soloveitchik had dinner. The Rav exaggerated, I think, but he said they had dinner every night. And I can tell you that I heard from Tursky, the Rav's oldest daughter, Atara Tursky, was born in Berlin. The first person at the hospital was Weinberg. That shows you how close they were in Berlin. When Rabbi Soloveitchik came to Berlin, he wasn't interested in these German Orthodox rabbis. He wanted to find rabbis who he could look up to as father figures, because he had left his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, and he found 2 gedolim, Rabbi Weinberg and Rav Chaim Heller, Heller became the father figure. Weinberg became very close to him, but then they had the disagreements. And Rav Huttner, Weinberg knew him. There's a letter in the Sri Deish to him, but Rav Huttner, now let me put it this way without getting into details. How religious Rav Huttner was in Berlin, there's a lot of yeshiva shalashin hara about Rav Huttner's time in Berlin, and let's just say that he wouldn't have been hanging out with the Lomdim. He went through a stage there, if the stories are correct, that he was not in their circles. I'm not saying that to put him down. I don't even know if it's true. But it comes from someone who's a very great scholar of the Lithuanian yeshiva world, that Rav Huttner had a time of falling away from orthodoxy during his period in Berlin. So, I mean, Agnon was another one in these groups. Agnon was not religious at all during those years. Weinberg did his wedding, incidentally. It's another story. Look, I see. Let me answer the last question. We'll end here, except for questions. We'll go on a few more minutes, and I'll pick up. We still have to conclude with his life in Berlin and why he's so important halachically, but let me answer these questions. What were the disagreements, Jonathan Hirsch says, between the Rav and Weinberg? Well, exactly what I said. The Rav, first of all, was not interested in scientific Jewish scholarship. He had no interest whatsoever in that. The Rav was not interested in German Orthodoxy. As I said, next class will begin with what the rabbinical seminary was. But the yeshiva university is a yeshiva, just like Brisk, just like Volozh, and at 3 o'clock or 12 o'clock, whatever, however long you study Talmud, you go upstairs and then you study English subjects. So the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary was about joining everything, combined. There really was synthesis there. So those were some of the disagreements, and there's other disagreements on Jewish law. Rabbi Soloveitchik was more conservative than Rabbi Weinberg. On the other hand, we'll get to it next class when we speak about some of his ideas. Next class I'll talk about the answers of Rabbi Kelman. What made the Hildesheimer Seminary unique? Why it's not Bar Ilan? Why it's certainly not Yeshiva University? And perhaps we can reflect a little on how Orthodoxy would be maybe better off had we have an institution like that. They wanted to move it to the land of Israel in the 30s, but the Gedolim were so opposed to it that they were forced not to, and now we can only speculate today how religious life would have developed in the land of Israel. If there's any other questions or comments, if not, I see it's 10 o'clock. I'll remain on a little bit if anyone wants to ask things or make comments.
I just want to say hello to everybody. I was here a few minutes late. So, want to say welcome, especially to people I don't know. Who haven't seen me before, if you want to identify yourself, email where you're from, etc. Like Noah Stern or Tobias Roth. Hello, and who do we have on the bottom?
Yeah, I told them before you came that if people miss a class, in fact, some people are probably going to miss the mayor from West Orange because they're showing the Rav movie in a few weeks on a Wednesday night, but that they could get the tapes. But however, Rabbi Kelman, it appears on your website as charging $3.99 Canadian dollars. There has to be a way to set it up that the people signed up for the course, they can get it for free.
I'm not so sure we can. It's very complicated to do it. It just might be too costly.
Okay.
Perfectly honest, it's not so simple.
Okay. We'll work on that.
Thank
but it's only $3.
I don't want to hear them have a whole discussion on price, but I can guarantee you at $19.99 for this course, we're losing lots of money. It doesn't come close to cover the cost of the course.
Okay.
We'd have to charge $60, $70 a person to cover the cost.
Okay.
So, and just, it costs money to put up the thing. So I just, if you miss the class, I just think you're going to have to pay $3.99 Canadian.
Okay.
It's too costly.
Okay. Take back what I said.
I hope people will understand and forgive me.
Okay.
And we want them to come to the class. We don't want them to listen.
Yeah. Two more questions quickly. What happened to Weinberg's ex-wife? She ended up marrying the rabbi of Helsinki. She lived in Helsinki in the 30s and then went on Aliyah, never had children. It's really a tragic case. I think most people who read the biography come out feeling inspired by Weinberg, but there's always some, including my grandfather was one, who had a feeling that Weinberg was a bit of a scoundrel, and it was really unfair how he treated this wife. And she's a young girl, she married him, it's not her fault, and here basically he just wants to abandon her, she's used goods. So she's a tragic figure, never able to have children, not because of any of her, but she was then too old, and she gets married to this rabbi, it's 20 years older than her, in Helsinki, and it's a real shame. He was succeeded, incidentally, by a great rabbi, Reb Aaron Valkin. for a very short time in Tovishok, who then went on and became the rabbi of Pinsk. But he had a son who survived, who came to America. It wasn't killed in the Holocaust. Some of you might know him, Rav Shmuel Valkin. He was a leading rabbi in the American Orthodoxy in the 50s. In fact, I believe he even put the hashkacha on Zim shipping, which had that big controversy with Rabbi Soloveitchik in the 50s. He also, in the time when all American Jews ate gelatin following Ratzi Pesach Frank's and Chaim Ozer Grzinski's hashuvot, he was one of the big mashkichim for gelatin, but an important rabbinic family. Now, as for the German Reform Movement, we'll speak about the German Reform Movement next class, because how to relate to the Reform Movement, the view in Berlin with Weinberg and Hildesheimer was very different than the view of Hirsch, how to relate to the Reform Movement. Suffice it to say that in one of Rabbi Weinberg's comments, the people got very upset when I published it, Rabbi Weinberg, in referring to one Reform rabbi, said that he's a Chil Hashem. Why is he a Chil Hashem? Because he shows that you could be a good, decent person with good values and not be Orthodox. And that's a Chil Hashem, because all the Orthodox are going to look at that and say that, you know something? It's not true what our rabbis are telling us, that the Reform rabbis are all wicked, evil people. So he was saying it obviously sarcastic. And Rabbi Weinberg had many good friends. Leo Beck, if you read what he writes about Leo Beck after Leo Beck passed away. So we're dealing with a different, but Reform Judaism, very different. He thought it was akin to Christianity. But we'll talk more about that next class, because it is one of the differences between him and Rav Soloveitchik, as well as the Haredi Orthodoxy. So this has been very interesting, I think. I like hearing the comments, questions.
Right,
if there's nothing else, I don't feel obligated to stay on. I'm going to stay on a little bit so I can speak to Rabbi Kellerman or if anyone else.
I'll go in 2 minutes. Yeah. You don't have to stay on two. We can pick up. But I assume, like, next week you'll pick up a little bit on the Chazon Ish also, or like...
No, next week half the class will be on Weinberg, and then we're going to move into a Herzog. We'll move into Rav Herzog, and then from Rav Herzog we'll move into the Chazon Ish. Rav Herzog, first chief rabbi of the State of Israel, a lot of interesting things. I mentioned to someone that some of you are probably going to be wondering with some of his ideas how he differs even from the early conservative movement. We'll talk about that.
All right, very, very good.
Okay.
I
thank you, everyone.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Bye, everyone.
Good night, everybody. Nice to see you. Those who I do see, and nice to. See the blank images you rename those, so I don't. Anyways, have a good week, everybody.
Do you want me to stay on?
You don't have to. You can go, I think. We'll
okay.
Let you go. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody.